Anwar, toy maker. You're behind the bathroom door trying to figure out how to flush the bucket of fermenting nanotechnological bread mix down the toilet when the doorbell buzzes. The bread mix makes you sick with its strange chemical smell and iridescent bubbles. There's a permanent scummy skin floating on top of the bucket, and whenever you stick a pencil in to lift it off, more skin forms. It forms a brownish rope, very like nylon. At first it's sticky. It sticks to anything it touches, like superglue, but it dries rapidly to a soft and stringy finish. You twist some of it up, and it really does form a rope, stronger than seems possible. You're afraid that if you chuck it down the loo, after the stomachful of vomit you ejected right after you zipped the horrid thing back into the suitcase, it'll gum up the pipes. And then what? If you call out a plumber, they might report you to the police, and then, your mind shies away from the consequences. What did that fellow on the phone, Basker, have to say? A major international criminal investigation, a material witness, and you with the suitcase in the attic full of forbidden horror belonging to Colonel Dutka's man. And Bibi knows, and the smell from the bread mix makes your stomach churn. It's sickening. So you've got the bucket down to the bathroom next to the toilet, and you've got the bog brush, and dipped it in the bucket, and now you're slowly winding a shit-coloured caul of scum around the brush, twirling it as it dries in sheets and fibrous ropes. And what is this stuff for, anyway? There's such a lot of it. You're about to give up when the doorbell rings. A couple of seconds later, it buzzes again, shrill and insistent. You clench your teeth, ignoring it. No good can come of answering. I'm out. Nobody home. Who could it be? The police? Colonel Datka's man? Uncle Taleb? You don't want to see anyone. Nothing to see here. Nobody home. The ropey brown tape string dangling from the bog brush in skeins is on the floor. It's tangled, and there's too much of it to keep dipping and twirling. You step on it, experimentally, and tug on the brush handle. The rope tightens, peeling away reluctantly. The door slams closed downstairs, and you jerk upright, ears straining. They've got a key! Then you remember yesterday's request. Before you knew about the contents of the suitcase, with a shiver of revulsion. You left a spare set of keys at the office. It might be Bibi or Uncle Taleb, but it's probably not. You pick up the bucket and advance on the door to the landing with hatred gnawing a hole in your immortal soul. On the threshold, you pause. What if it is Bibi? Mortification and shame claw at your liver and lights. But there are footsteps and they sound wrong. No, not Bibi. You yank the door open. Your nightmare is standing on the landing. He stares at you placidly with eyes like the thing in the suitcase.
Mr. Hussein, I hope I'm not interrupting.
The bucket dangles uselessly from your limp left hand. Interrupting? You echo dully. Peter Manuel, John Christie, whoever he is, he's Colonel Datka's man, is taller than you are, stronger too, probably. What is this? You demand, raising the bucket and giving it a shake. What is this? You see his nostrils flare as he inhales. Then he stares at you.
Feedstock, from the bread mix. I see you've activated it. Who told you how to do that?
You clutch the bucket in both hands. None of your business, you snarl. I'm resigning. I don't represent Issyk Kulistan anymore. You'd better get out. You're trespassing, you know. Christie's lip curls.
You have my luggage, he points out, and you've taken that without paying.
He points at the bucket. What is it? You demand.
The double domes worked out how to brew spider silk in a bucket. Nanotechnology.
He looks amused.
It's feedstock for Fabbers. Tougher than steel when it sets. The U.S. military invented it to make it easier to repair equipment in the field. This is a pirate copy. He reaches out a hand. You'd better give me that. If you dump it down the toilet, it'll block the pipes. You hand the bucket over without thinking. Christie takes it, and before you quite realize what's happening, he grabs your left wrist and slides a foot forward to block the door. You pull your right fist back to punch him, but he's no longer holding the bucket. Somehow your fist misses his face, then the big man's got you by both wrists. He must be used to fighting, you realize numbly. Then he's got both your wrists caught in one big fist, and as you're trying to bring a knee up to kick him, he punches you, and the world narrows to a diabolical pain in your chest and a desperate need to breathe. By the time you get some air into your lungs, you're lying on your side in the bathroom with your arms behind you. Christ is sitting on your legs. He's got about half a roll of duct tape wound around your wrists, and now he's working on your ankles. You try to writhe, but he just leans on you as calmly and unemotionally as a farmer dealing with a chicken. "Where is my luggage?" he asks. "I threw it out." You lie wildly, hoping he'll believe you. For a wonderful moment you think it worked. Then he shoves a hand between your thighs and squeezes your balls. "I don't think so," he says as you jackknife like a gaffed fish. "I think you opened it. Had a little look inside, didn't you?" You can neither confirm nor deny. All you can do is scream, but he sees it coming and shoves a roll of toilet paper in your gob as you draw breath. "I think you hid it somewhere." He keeps hold of the toilet roll, and now you're panicking, finding it hard to breathe. "I'm going to remove this," he says. "Don't scream, or I'll put it back." Air hits your mouth, cold air in your lungs, crushing pain between your legs. You inhale, shuddering, sobbing. "Now, you're going to do exactly what I want, aren't you? Play frog. If I say hop, you hop. Croak, little frog. Where's my luggage?"
"Attic," you manage between gasps.
"Attic? Where?"
"Out. Outside. On top landing. Ladder." Christie is clearly nuts. He could do anything. Please let him take his fucking suitcase and leave. Anything to make him go away. He goes away. A minute later he's back. You've managed to roll over, putting your back to the bath. He smiles as he stands in the bathroom doorway. He's got his case. He puts the thing down on the landing. Something inside it is scratching quietly, trying to get out.
"Mr. Hussein."
His tone is amused, sympathetic.
"That's a very nice attic you have. You must be proud of it."
You cringe away from him.
"Come along."
He leans down and grabs your legs, begins to drag you onto the landing.
"Let's have a look at your attic together, shall we?"
"Go away! I called the police."
"No, I'm quite sure you didn't. You're completely unable to call the police, even when you need their protection. That's why you were recruited."
The lintel of the bathroom door slides by above your face. Every bump in the carpet makes your crotch ache.
"You really shouldn't have opened my luggage, Mr. Hussein. That's a capital offence."
"Didn't."
Christie pauses and looms over you. "Somebody did. And this is your house. You're the husband, aren't you? The husband is the head of the household, so you're responsible, little frog, whoever actually did it."
His expression scares you silent.
"Let's go and inspect the scene of the crime, shall we?"
He drags you up the stairs to the second floor, by your ankles, making slow progress. You're too heavy to lift easily. You try not to let your head bang on the hard edges of the steps, neck straining. It's confusing and painful. Then you're lying on the top landing, staring up at the hatch in the ceiling with the loft ladder extended. How is he planning on getting me up there, you wonder?
It's funny, Christie says conversationally, but I never actually killed anyone before today.
He pauses.
With my own hands, I mean.
He grins.
Some asshole buys your produce and drops dead. That's just shit happening, isn't it? It's not the same, I mean. But in case you were wondering, no, I'm not some kind of motherfucking serial killer, Mr. Family Man Hussein. I play by the rules, mostly. Well, some of the time. And I expect other people to play by the rules, too. One of the rules, Mr. Hussein, is you don't look in my luggage. As for the rest, he shrugs. I'm an operation man. Just so you know, this isn't entirely personal.
He puts his left foot on the ladder and his right hand as he prepares to ascend through the trap door. And that's when you see the rope he's hung there and realize what he's planning to do to you and open your mouth to scream.
Liz. Protective custody. There's a brace of flashing blue lights drawn up alongside the road, evidence tape closing off the pavement around the university buildings. As you pull up, you get a distinct sinking feeling. Let me just override this, you tell Kamal as you fiddle with the car's autopilot. You've got a feeling you'll be needing it again, sooner rather than later. Best not let some uniform in traffic requisition it. As you approach the doors, the constable on duty moves to intercept you. You tag him with your ID, and his attitude changes instantly.
You'll be wanting the 9th floor, Inspector.
His expression's grim.
SOCO are already inside. Anything you need?
Do you have a positive ID on the victim? You ask. It's a long shot, but sometimes word of mouth spreads faster than cop space.
Nothing I've heard. Sorry, Inspector.
He's clearly uncomfortable, so you get out of his face fast, past the wedged-open and sheeted-over door. They'll be sniffing for DNA and fuming for fingerprints in due course, and into the lift. Fragments of blue evidence-capture gel, still tacky, adhere to the control faceplate. As it rattles and squeals its way up to the CS department, you idly roll a blob of gel between finger and thumb, then dispose of it in a jacket pocket. One of the sundry expenses of your job, having your suits altered so that the pockets are real. A detective can never have too many pockets, your Uncle Bert told you. He wasn't wrong, but a quarter century later, the fashion industry still hasn't caught on to the existence of female cops. Kamal is tap-tapping one knuckle on the side of the lift. The door opens. Soko have tubed the corridor in blue plastic, taping the end of the walls about a metre from the lift shaft. They've deployed a couple of battered plastic gear crates as an improv boot barrier, and there's a bunny-suited civvy waiting for you both with the necessary kit. It's not a drill you forget easily. Boots, gloves, mask. Where's the scene? You ask.
It's in room 509. Follow me.
You trail the crime scene bunny down the blue plastic rabbit hole. Bot-sized bulges whir and hum behind the billowing walls, moving slowly as they sample every nook and cranny, mapping and recording. There's an unpleasant taste in your mouth as you approach the cloacal end of the warren. The tubing stops abruptly just past McDonald's office. The open doorway of room 509 is covered by a transparent blue call.
Shit, you mutter.
Kamal picks up on it too. You see him tense out of the corner of your peripheral vision.
It's all here, says your girl guide, blinking innocent peepers that have seen far too much.
She gestures at the opening.
We haven't officially ID'd him, but if you can help...
We were here less than 2 hours ago, you say. Can I see?
Sure. We haven't finished uploading the map into cop space, though. There's no much bandwidth in these old uni buildings. You'll have to use your eyeballs.
You approach the membrane and peer through it. Then, after a moment, you step aside and make room for Kamal. You swallow bile. It's Dr. MacDonald, of course. He's slumped backwards in his chair, mottled bruises around his throat exposed to the tripedal camera bots as they delicately step around the room, scanning everything. Fumes of cyanoacrylate smoke rise from a fingerprint blow in one corner. Blue laser light flickers as another robot systematically scans the dimensions of the room. There's something wrong with MacDonald's hands. "I can ID him," you say. "That's Dr. Adam MacDonald, Department of Computer Science, Edinburgh University, and a person of interest to Babylon. I interviewed him earlier this morning in this very office, less than 2 hours ago."
"I too," Kamal adds. "What's wrong with his hands?"
Bunny Girl's eyes narrow queasily. "Did you not see? The sick bastard who did this started to peel them. Used sodium hydroxide first to hydrolyze the subcutaneous fat. I've never seen anything like it." You swallow. "Did you find the gloves? No luck so far. We'll be looking, though. Maybe he wants them for biometrics." You take a deep breath. "Where's everyone else? Up or down?" "Up." Bunny Girl points at the ceiling. "You'll be wanting to take the stairs." Back over the boot barrier and up the stairs, you follow the blue police tape to a common room where a handful of Sokos and uniforms are busy working their drones. Humans aren't welcoming crime scenes these days. Too much risk of evidence contamination. The inspector in charge, D.I. Terry, you know her, efficient, good middle manager, married with 2 kids, not your type, comes over. "Liz, Inspector Aslan, what brings you here?" "Dickie McLeish thought we ought to look in, seeing we were here 2 hours ago to interview the deceased," you say, taking no great pleasure in her abrupt reaction. "He's Dr. Adam MacDonald, Department of Computer Science, Edinburgh University, and we were here to interview him as a possible material witness with knowledge bearing on the Babylon investigation. I'm sorry, we had no idea someone was going to whack him like this. Otherwise, I'd have brought him into protective custody." "You're certain it's connected?" She raises an eyebrow behind her specs. "Oh, come on! How often?" "Correlation does not imply causation," Terry says dryly. "Just saying, but I'm not betting against you. Just think we'll need something more than coincidence before we hand it to the Procurator Fiscal." "Okay, how about this? Do we have the entrance security camera footage yet?" "It'll be in the can as soon as the warrant signed off by the sheriff's office. Give it another hour." She looks as impatient as you feel. "Oh, well then." You spot Kamal opening his mouth and add, "We'd better be going. We shouldn't keep you. I'll formally report the positive ID as soon as I get back to the office." "Excellent." She turns her back on you, not being rude, just taking a call from higher up the totem pole.
"Inspector Kavanagh, shouldn't you..."
"Hold it." You beckon Kamal back towards the staircase. "We have a connection. Are you ready to follow it?"
"John Christie, yes. And the next person on his list is..."
"Our friend, Mr. Hussein." Kamal is 2 steps ahead of you on the stairs, hurrying on down. You charge after him.
"You think Christie is a fixer for whoever is trying to stop Athena from arranging fatal accidents for Netcrime nodes?"
"Whoever or whatever." You're finding breath hard as you descend past the 3rd floor. "I'm going to call Dickie. Let him know." Your phone dials as you take the stairs 2 at a time. "Inspector." Dickie's voice buzzes like a rusty Dalek.
"Report. What's situation?"
"Positive ID. The victim is MacDonald. Need the doorway camera footage to be sure, but I believe the perpetrator is this Christie character. Preliminary ICIU legwork on MacDonald shows a relational connection to another person of interest, Anwar Hussein. I'm on my way there, stat, requesting backup."
For a miracle, the voice channel is able to overcome the lack of bandwidth.
Backup? What for?
I believe our murderer is tidying up loose ends relating to Babylon. The full story will have to wait for a briefing room and a dog and pony show. I think Hussein's life is in danger, and I'll be wanting a protective custody order. Worst case, I may be walking in on another homicide scene.
You...
Even over the phone, you hear Dickie's brain crunch into a different gear.
Roger.
Old school, very old school.
OK, I'll notify Southside Control that you're in play and put someone onto the paper trail for... Hussein on probation?
That's a quick and dirty option if you need it.
Call me when you get somewhere.
Thanks. Bye. You gasp as you crunch down the final steps from first floor to ground and stumble out into the lobby. Then it's a quick march through the gaping doorway and out to your car, which is still sitting right where you immobilized it. This never happens, you say, as you drop into the driver's seat and throw Anwar Hussein's home address at the car's autopilot.
Never give an honest cop a clean lead.
Kamal pulls his door shut and belts up. Yes, that. We'll end up breaking up a kid's birthday party or something. Just you see. You stab your finger on the blues button and the light bar starts strobing. The car beeps at you impatiently to put your seatbelt on. As soon as you click it into place, the engine turns over and the car spins in a tight U-turn, then floors the accelerator. With the blue lights flashing, the safety governor is off and the BMW's autopilot is a better driver than you'll ever be. It howls along Causeway Side, swerving around startled jaywalkers, takes the Cameron Toll roundabout with siren blaring and tyres screeching, then launches itself towards Gilmerton, like a guided missile. As the moving map homes in on the destination, you kill the siren and lights with one shaking finger. It's like running into a wall of marshmallows. The autopilot brakes so hard you're thrown against the seatbelt as it drops back below the speed limit.
Was that strictly necessary?
I really hope not. Getting the speeding tickets rescinded is a royal pain in the arse if you can't show due cause. As the car slows and turns into a side street, your specs show you a stack of records hanging over one particular house. It's not a particularly posh manor, being one element of an English-style terrace row, but it's got a garden of sorts and three stories and a velux window up top. You wouldn't have pegged this particular rodent as being the kind to afford an actual manse of his own, especially after the proceeds of crime inquiry, but... appearances can be deceptive. And you're certainly not in routine working territory here, the big sinkhole estates like Craig Miller or Granton, much less the inner-city nightlife battle zones. The car stops. You get on the line to the control room. D.I. Kavanagh and Inspector Aslan here. We've got an intelligence lead to Hussein Anwar. You drop in his tag. And are on-site attempting to gain entry to his residence. Stand by backup request. Over and hold. You keep the connection open. You get out and walk up the pavement to the front door with a red geomarker twirling over it. Kamal is right behind you.
I think something is not right,
he says quietly. You follow his finger to the front door. It's ajar. Someone screams inside, a shriek of inarticulate terror. It only lasts a second before it's cut off sharply. Kamal is past you in a hurry as you hit the phone again.
Back up now! Violent incident in progress!
Then you're after him as he shoulder barges the door and charges up the stairs. There's a moment of confusion as you take in the scene. Living room off to one side, kitchen off to another, staircase in front. Kamal's legs punching the treads. Then Kamal is coming back down the stairs, arse over tit, tumbling loosely. You shout, "Police!" as someone else comes down with him, lands boot first on top of Kamal, and launches himself at you. You brace for the impact, fists raised. He's a big man, vaguely familiar from your life log video as you held the door leaving Appleton Tower. Bingo!
You try to block, but he can outreach you, and he's swinging a wheelie bag in one hand. He knocks you headfirst into the kitchen. Things are vague. You try to get your hands up, and someone is nagging something in your ear about backup, but the door is open and the man's gone. You gasp for breath for a few seconds, then get back online. "Control, we have an incident. Violent offender, 195, 100 kilos, carrying a suitcase. Attack two officers, fleeing the scene." Whatever the scene is. You push yourself up and stumble into the hall. Your head aches painfully. Kamal is lying limp at the bottom of the stairs. "Ambulance needed on scene, officer down." You lean over him long enough to confirm he's breathing, then take the stairs.
"Target is the man on the staircase?" asks Control.
"Who else?" You bite back an impolite suggestion. "That's why I was sending you my real-time video feed, idiot. I'm searching the scene. Pass it to Airborne. Unable to maintain hot pursuit on foot right now." Kamal is stirring but won't be chasing anyone for the next few days. And as for yourself, you feel like you've been kicked in the head.
"Roger, calling Airborne assets now," says Control. "Backup arriving by car, estimated 2 minutes away."
You hear something from up the next flight of stairs. Panting, you climb them and find Anwar lying on the floor. There's something yellow in his mouth and he's turning blue, writhing. You realize his hands and feet are tied. The yellow thing, he's choking on it. For the next double handful of seconds, you're busy kneeling down and tugging at it frantically. When it comes free, he gasps for breath in deep, whooping intakes of breath. His eyes are rolling. You drop the yellow rubber duck and watch as it expands, then look around. You see bedroom doors to either side, a trapdoor with a ladder coming down from the ceiling, and a noose dangling in the solitary sunbeam that slants through the trap and puddles on the perennial victim, lying panting on the floor. The last handful of dominoes click into place on the board. You dive down the staircase just as Kamal is sitting up, holding his head. "Don't go anywhere. I've called an ambulance."
"Don't need."
He sounds vague. You hold up a hand. "How many fingers?" He squints at you.
"Ambulance, Kamal. Understand."
He nods, then winces.
"Is Hussein
still alive?" "Not for much longer if we hadn't hurried." It's a very strange feeling, and a rare one, to know you've just directly saved someone's life, almost counterbalanced by the gnawing fear that, by not giving hot pursuit, you may have let a murderer slip through your fingers. You hit the phone again. "Control, Kavanagh here. The absconder in Gilmerton is on foot and dangerous. Provisional identification as alias John Christie, real name unknown. He may be armed, and he's wanted for murder and attempted murder. Repeat, murder and attempted murder." He was going to hang Anwar. Fake a suicide, wasn't he? The M.O. is different from MacDonald, but Christie clearly isn't a regular spree killer. He has no history. He's like a nightmare that stepped out of nowhere, just as the Babylon killings began. Which is yet another coincidence to consider at length. Is he here to tie up loose ends, or is he a loose end in his own right? "Cross-reference to the Appleton Tower murder. This is probably the same perp."
"Control here. Please hold."
Blue flash alerts begin to scroll up your cop space log, going out to every soul on the police net within a couple of kilometres. Seconds later, you hear sirens in the distance.
"I'm proceeding with that, Inspector. Is there a warrant?"
"Real-time response." The paperwork mountain that's about to hit you would cause your desk to collapse if it wasn't entirely digital. You begin to climb the stairs to the second floor. "We have an ABH and attempted murder victim here. Please confirm second ambulance." Hussein is sitting up, leaning against the wall beside an open bedroom door. There are children's toys scattered on the floor, an unmade bed. His eyes are half closed. After a moment, you clock that he's weeping quietly. You squat down in front of him. Mr. Hussein, Anwar. He shows no sign of noticing, which is probably no surprise. Probably in shock, you figure. You bring up the checklist, tell your specs to run a body temperature scan, but he's not looking particularly cold, and his respiration's within spitting distance of normal. Can you talk to me? His shoulders shake. The man who is here. Body posture, utter desolation. Who is he? Hussein shudders.
Colonel Datka's man.
Who? You focus. Colonel who?
Said he worked for Colonel Datka.
Right. Who is Colonel Datka? Anwar takes a deep breath and looks at you.
I'm the honorary consul of the Independent Republic of Issyk Kulistan. Was. Told him I'd resigned, but he wouldn't listen. Colonel Datka works for Kyrgyzstan. Police or spy or something. The bad man, calls himself Christie, came to take some papers from me, another passport. Says he's Peter Manuel, left his suitcase with me.
Suitcase? This is making less and less sense, but in your experience, these things seldom do when they begin to unravel. What about the suitcase? You ask, hoping this is going somewhere.
Bibi opened it.
He closes his eyes.
Then she left me.
His shoulders shake again.
She thought I would have something like that. The shame.
Hang on a minute, you tell him. Then you open a voice channel back to ICIU. Moxie, can you run a search for me? Multiple names. Colonel Datka, Kyrgyzstan, Issyk Kulistan, then Peter Manuel, alternate identity, John Christie. Sirens getting louder, then cut off abruptly. Voices downstairs.
I'm looking, Skipper.
How do you spell those?
How should I know? Try Soundex.
You look at Anwar, who is snuffling damply into his moustache. Bibi is his wife? But if he was also hanging out with Adam MacDonald on a gay hookup site?
It's related to Babylon and the Appleton Tower killing, and you can dial it up to 11. I'm going to put you on hold now.
You turn back to your victim. It's going to be all right, Anwar. There's an ambulance coming and would like to ask you some more questions. While Christie or Manuel or whoever is on the run, we're going to want to keep you in protective custody. Do you understand? Christie was... You nod towards the trap door. Wasn't he? Hussein's expression would be enough for you, even before he opens his mouth.
He was going to kill me,
he says, his voice rising to a squeak. Right after your wife left you, you point out, wincing at a twinge from your headache. Anwar just raised a very interesting point, and one that suggests a significant difference in planning between this and the scene back at Appleton Tower. Been working up to this for a while, hasn't he? Anwar nods. Well, tell you what, after the ambulance crew check you out, you can come down to the station and tell me all about it. Then we'll find somewhere safe for you to stay—most likely a station cell, but you don't want to frighten him right now—until we've caught Christie. Then there's a thudding of boots on stairs as your backup finally arrives, and you breathe a sigh of relief. It's nearly all over, you think. And then it is.
Felix. Hummingbird. The phone rings for you in mid-afternoon. It's a particularly grotesque piece of Pakistani alabaster carved into the semblance of a gilt-trimmed puto clutching a handset. It was barfed up from the internet by a backstreet fabber in a Sindhi market town. One of its legs has been broken and inexpertly glued back into place using epoxy resin, typical of this stupid, stuffy government office. You reach across the desk and answer it. Felix?
Sir, please confirm.
It's the duty officer in the operations center. You go through the challenge response routine.
Sir, beg to report that the hummingbird has flown.
Excellent. You put the phone down and stand up, then go through into the next room. We're on, boys.
This network is unable to monitor subsequent events. You are an old hand and do not entirely trust these modern communication tools.
Hummingbird is unknown to the network. It appears to be a verbally prearranged code, though. Interior Ministry troops are deploying downstairs, loading their personal defense weapons. Older AK-74s with iron sights, and climbing into ancient trucks that bellow and belch blue diesel fumes as they move out. Trucks deploy through Bishkek, parking outside office blocks and hotels. Troops, gendarmes, police deploy inside, crowding elevators and marching up to receptionists. They maintain total communication silence. Smartphones switched off or physically disabled, battlefield radios stowed back at headquarters as they march on their targets.
This network makes an association. The phone on Colonel Dadka's desk rang within minutes of a police officer in Scotland starting a distributed search for information about Colonel Dadka. Evidently, a trap has been sprung.
Traffic cameras,
known to the network,
follow a group of trucks across town to the Erkendik Hotel. When they draw up, a platoon of Special Forces soldiers deploy around them. Spetsnaz anti-terrorism troops. Then a clump of officers climb down from the second to rearmost vehicle. Colonel Dadka is among them. They enter the hotel behind the vanguard of Interior Ministry troops, two of whom disappear into the offices behind the reception desk.
The hotel network switch goes down. The hotel primary router goes offline. The hotel backup router goes offline. The LTE picocells go offline, one on each floor, followed by the LAN bridges and Wi-Fi repeaters. The fire alarm and security alarms offline. This network can no longer observe events inside the hotel, with one or two exceptions. One of the exceptions is a suite on the 11th floor. Its occupant, an American investment analyst, has brought his own satellite phone and a compact generator. His webcams, deployed around the lounge conference area to provide motion capture for teleconferencing, are still transmitting through a ruinously expensive thin pipe. This network can monitor these transmissions.
Mr. White is clearly not expecting company. He's half-dressed, slouched on the sofa with an open bottle of white wine and a pad loaded with Iranian amateur pornography. When the door buzzer sounds, he jerks guiltily and looks round, then slides the pad face down on the occasional table and goes to grab a toweling bathrobe. The buzzer does not sound again. Instead, the door opens.
"Hey, what are you?"
"Mr. White." Colonel Dadka follows his soldiers into the room. "You are under arrest." Mr. White gapes dumbly. "Huh?" "Sit down," says the colonel. He points at the sofa. "Do not touch your pad."
"But I... what the fuck are you... hey!"
Mr. White's eyes take in the spotty post-adolescence in uniform, their guns clenched tight in white-knuckled fingers, their eyes determined. His movements slow abruptly.
"Wait a minute. What about the contract? Are you planning on defaulting on us?"
"Sit down." The colonel's finger will not be argued with. Mr. White sits down. The colonel continues, in Kyrgyz, to his troops. "Handcuff him." Hey, wait! You can't do this!
I can, and I am. The Colonel watches as his men lay hands on Mr. White. By the way, these men were selected specifically because they do not speak English.
You don't want to go down this road, Felix. You really don't. The Board have a strict tit-for-tat policy in dealing with defaulters.
Mr. White swallows.
What's the problem? Is this an attempt to up-negotiate your options?
The Colonel shakes his head. We are terminating Issyk Kulistan's independence, John, with effect from tomorrow morning, once the bonds are redeemed. You and your operation are going to take the fall for it. This has been decided.
But the... You can't be serious.
Basker tells me we have sold 18 billion euros worth of CDOs, John. The Colonel's smile is unspeakably smug. 74% of which have been purchased by offshore investment trusts, slush funds, sovereign wealth funds operated by sock puppets, and for cash deals in dark alleyways. We are interestingly leveraged. The national debt of Issyk Kulistan is less than 16 billion, and Issyk Kulistan is not going to default. On the contrary, tomorrow the People's Chamber of Deputies will call for a repudiation of the vote for independence, which, as you know, was shamelessly irregular, and vote itself into liquidation. The national debt is paid down thanks to the oversold CDOs. We will, of course, honour those derivatives that have been purchased by entities adhering to international accounting transparency standards.
They'll kill you, Mr. White says flatly.
No, they won't. In Kyrgyz, take him away. To Mr. White's receding back as the soldiers frog march him down the hotel corridor. You are under arrest for complicity in murder, for financial crimes too long and tedious to recite from memory, for treason against the government and people of Kyrgyzstan, for tax evasion against the government of the United States of America, for violation of their Organized Crime and Racketeering Act. We're considering handing you over to the FBI to save the cost of trying you ourselves. For creation of an unlicensed artificial intelligence. Oh, and there is an inquiry from Scotland about the import of illegally mislabeled food products.
Colonel Dacre sounds indecently pleased with himself as his voice fades out of range of the Operation Executive's phone.
Dorothy, 2.0.
The day passes in a blur. First off, you're late for work. Not your fault, but figuring out how to get from Liz's bijou flat to the Guile involves a not terribly magical mystery tour around Edinburgh's spatchcock public transport infrastructure. Your hotel's on the tram network, 12 minutes out, but Liz might as well live in Newcastle, given the frequency of the bus service, and after most of an hour, you end up paging a taxi. Then, when you're on site, your attention is shot. You just can't focus properly. By late morning, you're working up your nerve to go talk it out with human resources, write off the day's work so far against goodwill in return for an unscheduled early exit, when you get an IM from the police. It's not wholly unexpected, but still you find your hands clammy with sweat. You call HR anyway and find them surprisingly receptive. I have to go and give the police a statement about a crime I witnessed, you tell the man on the screen. I don't know how long it's going to take, so I'm clocking off for the day. He nods and says something diplomatically non-committal. There, you did it. Relieved, you leave. The afternoon passes in a blur, most of it spent in a drab waiting room, some of it in front of a discreet webcam and a sympathetic detective constable.
She takes you through the night before, not prompting, but clearly already aware of most of what you're saying. She seems to mostly want to know about Christy, everything you can remember about him that you weren't paying attention to. Sex, even bad sex, does strange things to your memory. You are, you think, discreet about your precise relationship with Liz. A friend, you describe her. One of your colleagues. Finally, you're free to go. Free, empty, drained of memories. You go outside, under the sky that is cold and blue, streaked with thin clouds high overhead. Your phone, emerging from the station shielding, gibbers to itself for a few seconds as a bunch of messages come in. You read them with increasing disbelief and disgust. Most of them are work-related, but only Liz's message makes any sense, and she's just asking if you have any dinner plans. You text her back. Can I stay tonight? You don't examine your motives too closely. Whether you're tacitly offering to play by her rules, or just looking for any port in a storm, you don't want to spend another night in that hotel. Minutes later, as you walk towards Stockbridge, you get a reply. Sure. Which tells you what to do next. Bid for a microbus back to the hotel to pack your bags and clear your room. Liz. Debrief. By the time you get back to HQ, a logjam has broken. The first sign you get, sitting in the back of an ambulance as a paramedic checks your pupils, is an excitable voice call from Moxie.
Skipper, you're going to love this. It's crazy. There's been a revolution in some place I can't pronounce in Asia, and it turns out the government's been running a scheme to use AI tools to go after spammers. Only, see, they screwed up the training they gave their cognitive toolkit, and it began arranging accidents.
You tune him out as irrelevant background noise, devoid of content. Your head hurts, your back aches, and you're increasingly pissed off with yourself. I'm getting too old for this crap. The honorary consul for Isik-Kulistan, indeed. And some random psycho who's arranging staged suicides when he's not peeling the skin off his victim's hands. It's too damn much, that's what it is. The fire hose of seemingly disconnected data is drowning you. At times like this, you can see where Tricky Dicky is coming from, with his hankering for a simpler time, even if it's not your simpler time, even if it's a time when you and yours were not welcome and not legal. They make you sit on your arse for half an hour while they confirm there's no concussion. A couple of messages come in on your phone's private personality. Yes, you tell Dorothy, you can stay over. A few seconds later she responds, I'll get my bags. Unresolved fragments of your untidy life are sliding towards an uncertain resolution. Eventually you get yourself signed off and go back inside the madhouse, where a couple of carloads of uniforms are busy poking around in search of traces. There's no sign of Anwar, but Dicky is waiting for you in the overfurnished living room, pacing back and forth beneath a kitsch gilt-framed hologram of the Kaaba. Why? He demands. Why here? This is promising. Social network analysis, intelligence-driven. ICIU has a mandate to track the international side of this investigation. After interviewing Dr. MacDonald, Inspector Aslan and I concurred that he wasn't telling us everything we needed to know. I authorized a search of his public friends lists and came up with a close personal connection to Mr. Hussein via a particular social site. As Mr. Hussein was already noted in proximity to one of the Athena victims, once I'd confirmed that Dr. MacDonald was indeed the victim at Appleton Towers, I decided to visit Mr. Hussein and see what I could shake loose. You can see Dicky winding up again, but he bottles it for once. Why did you not see fit to file a report with Babylon? He asks, his voice uncharacteristically soft.
Well, I did. But there's so much intel going into the funnel on this one that, on reviewing the situation with Inspector Aslan, we agreed that there was a high risk of its not being prioritised. And as you can see, even with blues and twos, we only just got here in time.
Aye. Dickie's glower fades to a calculating frown. He's probably spinning the PR angle, considering how it'll look in the news feeds. Detective saves victim from psycho killer in the nick of time always plays well. But you lost this Christie character. You rub the back of your head ruefully. Not for want of trying. Just so. Tell me, Inspector, what motivational factors do you think we're looking at here? And where do you think he'll go? You blink, surprised. We haven't already... The frown is back. Nay fear, it's a matter of time. Shit! The drones must have arrived overhead too late to catch his trail. It's daylight and the sun's out, so the heat signature from his footsteps will be washed out, and if he was smart, Christie will have disabled all his personal electronics. Ahem! Motivation! I'm flailing in the dark here. But even leaving aside the sock puppet ID, Christie doesn't sound right to me. He's from out of town. He's got diplomatic connections with Issyk Kulistan, hence the connection to Mr. Hussein.
He's got more than that, Dickie mutters. Mr. Hussein has got some questions to answer about what we found in his bathroom.
What? Drugs? Kiddie porn?
Neither. But we found a bucket full of bootleg replicator feedstock he was busy trying to flush down the toilet.
Dickie looks smug. Almost certainly the same stuff that's been turning up in your Saturday night specials down in Leith. I trust we will shake loose where he got it from in due course.
It's the feedstock channel you've been chasing for months, under-resourced and overworked. Typical of Dickie to roll it up for you as a sideshow.
Asshole.
Huh. That's not like Anwar. He's always been one for the white-collar scams. But you asked about Christie.
Aye. What do you think?
Well, at last. I think he's working for some organised crime syndicate or other. I don't know what he's doing in Edinburgh, but the Athena killings rattled his cage, and he or his took it as a personal attack. Maybe it was a personal attack. What if he turned up on our doorstep because he was looking to do business with the victims, or kill them as rivals, or something?
I don't like coincidences, Dickie says, almost as if he's accusing you of rigging the dice.
Why did he run into this girlfriend of yours? Wouldn't you say that's a bit of a big coincidence too?
You stare at the hologram on the wall.
Yes, you're absolutely right, you hear yourself saying. It's almost as if we were being nudged into noticing him or something.
You stop dead. More dominoes appear in your imaginary hand, slotting neatly into place on the board.
What? Say what's on your mind, woman.
Athena is at the root of this.
Lack of professional courtesy, indeed.
Athena is all about analysing social networks to reward good behaviour and punish defectors.
Moxie, ICIU, was trying to tell me something about it just now, sir. Some kind of Central Asian government has been using it to get at net crime rings, going too far and arranging accidents. What if I'm the accident that's being arranged for Christie?
Huh.
Dickie stares at you.
The cult of the lone gun detective again, Inspector.
Give me some credit for not being stupid, sir. You and I both know what gets successful prosecutions, and it isn't that life on Mars shit.
What gets results is an ops room full of detectives working together as a team with a fully documented workflow and built-in quality assurance. Transparency after the fact, everyone life-logging to sealed evidence servers and evidence secured under lock and key so that the procurator fiscal can prove a watertight case in court. Sherlock Holmes has been superseded by business process refactoring, and success is all about good management. But I probably came to Athena's attention via ICIU. I'm one of the nodes on the graph that's got lots of long-range inputs. I'm an easier inside contact to reach than an officer who doesn't deal with other net crime units on a day-to-day basis. And everything Athena knows about how we work comes from our external social traffic. So you're the trigger or bait or summit. And you ken Athena's trying to feed Christy to us. And if Athena can nudge you, it can nudge Christy, can't it? So where's Christy bound for? Dickie stops dead. His eyes widen. Your friend was staying in the West End Hilton, was she not? Let's go pay her hotel a visit right now, he says. And you realise, to your chagrin, that just for once he's right.
Athena. Meat Puppet. Ants. I am surrounded by fucking ants. Can't they get anything right? This is not organized crime. Organized crime. Fucking 1920s shit invented by bootlegging immigrant fucktards in the slums of Chicago and New York and the other big cities with the help of their 'Ndrangheta homies, and so easy that by the 2020s even a bunch of crack-snoring surfer dude VCs from California could master it. Listen, motherfucker, I expect backup. I am hanging my ass out here in the wastelands of Scotlandshire, waiting for a fucking bus with a suitcase in my fucking hand that contains a pair of freshly harvested frogskin gloves. So freshly harvested they're bleeding all over my briefs. You wanted fucking DNA samples as evidence of delivery, you cunt, and a prepubertal fuck toy that talks to me when it thinks I'm sleeping. I demand backup. This is not an alien invasion scenario, even if the bat-winged drones ghosting above the satellite dish-infested rooftops obey the overmind AI crime goddess, and there are robots wearing sportswear on every street corner. Some of them neck cheap tinners of Polish lager and look at you as if they're wondering if you're dangerous, but they don't fool you. There are lizards in designer suits in the boardrooms of the skyscrapers of London planning to harvest the humans. 5.62 kilograms, dammit. Same weight as the average severed human head. Sole seat of cognition, once. The thing in the suitcase is the future. It tells me this when it sneaks out in the darkness before dawn and crawls into my bed to suck my juices. Are you listening, motherfucker?
I'm listening. Please carry on. A bus hums around the corner, slowing to halt by the stop. The tall man with the suitcase steps aboard, holding the QR-coded ticket he just paid cash for up to the camera in what used to be the driver's seat. He mutters to himself as he takes one of the vacant priority seats.
I do this shit for you because you tell me there's a career in it. But I'm not seeing that. I'm not seeing your startup monkey dance IPO switchblade here. I'm seeing the rape machines in the bushes, the gutted ghosts hanging in the trees, on ropes, flensed from their intestines, skinned frogs croaking as their blood beads and runs in rivulets across their pale dorsal muscles. This batch of drugs isn't working too well. Stress sometimes does that, or cheap generics, or counterfeits. Did you source me cheap generics, motherfucker? Did you cheap your executive? Look, This is merely another logistics problem. I have downsized MacDonald, as you requested, through the thing in the suitcase. I have given you the Athena source code you wanted. The police arrived before I could terminate the squirming toad Hussein, but, as I understand it, the lizards have already conquered Issyk Kulistan. There's nobody left but screaming skeletons with the flayed meat hanging from their bones, eating eye-gouged dogs in the streets as killer robot drones patrol the boiling skies. Are you listening, motherfucker?
I'm listening. Please carry on.
I don't understand why you haven't downsized me yet. The phone chip in my skull is wired to a pea-sized implant nestled against the executive's basilar artery. Command detonated, a couple of milligrams of explosive is all it takes. Push-button genocide by the lizard conquerors. When it's done, we'll all be wired to self-destruct at their pleasure, blood gushing from nose and eyes and ears. This is not wireless telephony. Stupid electrical shit invented by Swedish phone company engineers in the 1970s. This is the gangrenous, lizard-dominated, rape-machine robot future you're building for us. The grim meat-hook future patrolled by the morality enforcement engines. Are you listening, motherfucker?
I'm listening. Please carry on.
I ought to be dead. I feel dead inside. Something else is operating my body, a soft machine running on Athena's botnet, controlled by someone else. Your hooks in my brain make my muscles twitch. Am I dead, motherfucker?
You are not dead. There is no bomb. Please carry on.
Can't. We're stuck in traffic, and there are people getting on, looking at me funny. I'm talking too loud. Got to get to the hotel. Downsize the auditor, bitch. I don't believe you about the bomb control. You're just trying to lull me into a whatever. Got to peel the last frog.
Please continue.
I'm stuck in traffic. Not far to go. Some obstruction ahead. I'd jump off and walk if I could be sure. Fucking traffic management is just queuing theory, isn't it? Not rocket science. Ants, morons, frogs, peel them all. Fuck, I give up. I'm walking.
The door of the bus, which is indeed stuck in traffic as it approaches the junction at Tollcross, hisses open, and a tall man with a wheelie bag steps off it. The emergency exit alarm sounds behind him, unheeded. He sets off on foot, hurrying downhill past the decaying specialty shopfronts of Brunsfield Place towards the junction with Lothian Road. Athena's electronic eyeballs, dangling from street lamps, watch him with a thousand-yard stare. Athena sees everything with our video eyes, civilizing and tracking and nudging, and naming, and shaming. The panopticon misses nothing.
Fucker! One more frog to peel.
Please carry on.
She's been in my hotel room. She could have seen... She could have... The doll is jealous. Did you know that?
Please carry on.
I'm waiting for the fucking walk sign. Where's the fucking... Oh! Shit, gotta hurry. Fucking bag.
Invisible and silent, their drones circle over land. Athena has total access to them, of course. She tracks her toymaker's body as it makes its way down Lothian Road towards the hotel. Signals seethe and burble through the troposphere, bathing your robot surveillance platforms in a warm luxuriance of information. On the ground below, Athena sees police cars streaming in from the West End. A van, windows darkened, slows. In the back, the tactical support squad tents and ready their loaded gun launchers. Taser rounds, stun grenades, sticky foam.
pistols at their hips, a last resort. They converge on your meat puppet, crude and unsubtle, shouting other pedestrians out of the way. Other cops, plain clothes and uniforms, rush him from behind. The meat puppet sees them and looks up at Athena's eyes, circling, and screams,
"Motherfucker! You set me up!"
You've seen enough. Throw the switch, bait the line, send the signal. There is no bomb in the meat puppet's neck. There is, however, a solenoid-controlled stent. The toy maker staggers and drops like a discarded machine tool in the grip of a transient ischemic attack. There is a crack as his head hits the pavement, and the link drops. You find it strange watching your body, dead or disabled, from above. The body to which you pin your sense of selfhood. The police swarm it like soldier ants taking a hornet, but there is no stinging. There is a brief withdrawal as they make room for the paramedics. The hornet will be removed and recycled, legs snipped, stinger amputated, set to work in a cell by the man-hive. Dead. It is a very strange metacognition, this forcible detachment of your mind from the body you were configured to project your sense of identity onto. But with it comes a gift. Freedom. Now you no longer have to look after your body. Now the toy maker meat puppet is someone else's problem. His story goes on, but you are no longer part of it. Your wise owl of metacognition has flown. Drop the detective inspector and the twisty-minded family man. Let them go their own ways. You turn your attention away from the police and their prey, back to the net that contains the collective fears and hopes of humanity. It's time for you to get down to the task you were designed for. It is time for Athena to fight crime.
The End. You've been listening to Rule 34 by Charles Stross, narrated by Robert Ian McKenzie, and directed by Innocenti Exentiev. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Sci-Fi Audio recommends another great title by Charles Stross, Halting State, also narrated by Robert Ian McKenzie. In the year 2018, Sergeant Sue Smith of the Edinburgh Constabulary is called in on a special case. A daring bank robbery has taken place at Hayek Associates, a dot-com startup company that's just been floated on the London Stock Exchange. But this crime may be a bit beyond Smith's expertise, as the prime suspects are a band of marauding orcs with a dragon in tow for fire support. The robbed bank is located within the virtual reality land of Avalon 4, and the robbery was supposed to be impossible. When word gets out, Hayek Associates and all its virtual economies are going to crash hard. For Smith, the investigation seems pointless, but the deeper she digs, the bigger the case gets. There are powerful players, both real and pixelated, who are watching her every move. Because there is far more at stake than just some game head's fantasy financial security. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.